Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to your absolute favorite Saturday morning program, heard exclusively here on WEEB. I'm Steve Woodward, joined by David Hensley.
Good morning. Stereo.
Good morning, David.
Good morning, Steve.
We took a week off to observe the Thanksgiving season. We had a great pre-recorded show with two young ladies from the Changing Destinies Ministry that is archived on the WEEB website, if you'd like to track that down and hear about the wonderful work they're doing at Changing Destinies. I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge our wonderful sponsor, The Marketplace Restaurant and Catering. Since 1980, your go-to for breakfast and lunch, especially the newly introduced breakfast burritos, and also catering services for all your needs, from the intimate office party to the wedding of the century, even a divorce proceeding, if you need that catered.
They'll do it.
They can help you out with that. Absolutely. It's a great operation. So, The Marketplace.
Yeah, so if you're not fortunate enough to have Chef Hensley's, short order cook Hensley's stuff right off my griddle in the morning, then go to The Marketplace and get their breakfast burrito.
Well, it's a little more convenient to go to The Marketplace, but anyway. Well, we have a lot to get to today, and of course, we always kick off the big show here on Taking Aim by identifying from a usually jammed roster and narrowing down and revealing public enemy number one for the week that was, and we could probably do this every week, but yes. It's particularly egregious what the corrupt media has been up to recently in their lust to take out Secretary of War Pete Hegseth, to bring him down, to force him out and damage and smear him permanently. They have gladly and gleefully overlooked the efforts that are being made to kill and thwart narco-terrorists on the open seas, which is a priority, one of the priorities of the Trump administration, because they're bringing all kinds of deadly drugs, especially fentanyl, into our country. They have been doing it with impunity for years and years and years. Now we're blowing them up with video rolling, and it's fun to watch. You can't watch it enough. Of these narco boats being blowed up, except for the fact that the left, the Dems, and some, it won't surprise you, a few Republicans, including North Carolina's...
Wait for it. Let me guess. Oh, one guess.
Yeah, one guess.
Join the mainstream media in attacking the Trump administration.
Yes.
And he's a North Carolina senator.
Yes.
Oh, God.
And he was the very lame before he became even a lame duck. He was.
Oh, wait. That's the person that the Moore County GOP wouldn't censor, and their justification for not, I can't remember his name, their justification for not censoring him was that Trump was going to endorse him, and if they censored him, then in effect they would be censoring Trump, because Tillis, that's his name, The Moore County GOT, Tom Beto blocked his censoring because his fellow Tom, the logic was it was the most amazing thing in the world. Trump was going to endorse Tillis, so therefore if the Moore County GOP censored Tillis, then we would in effect be censoring Trump. It was the, I mean, I watched this play out in real time. I watched them convince themselves that that's why they couldn't censor Tillis. And you know the flaw in their argument that I pointed out? What happens if Trump doesn't censor, doesn't endorse Tillis? And guess what? Trump didn't endorse Tillis.
There you go.
Anyway, I'm sorry for hijacking
the, that. The subtitle of this program ought to be where we rip the scabs off of old wounds, I think. But anyway.
Yes, yes.
So let's get back to the point here, which is public enemy number one. The corrupt media has been wringing its wrists and squealing to the sky over the fact that one of these boat attacks by U.S. forces to take out narco-terrorists apparently involved a second strike in order to finish off the job, in order to kill more bad guys and to stop them from delivering the goods on the boat in question. So now, all of a sudden, guess what happens? One news organization finally has to come around. The New York Times actually has led the way a little bit on this. Mm-hmm. And now it appears that the second strike on this boat was not some kind of a terrible example of a war crime, which has been bandied around, but instead was a very legitimate and necessary response by the U.S. Play yes. Clip one.
So we've seen the video of the first strike, but that second strike video that the president said would be released will be key. And tonight, new information. According to a source familiar with the incident, the two survivors climbed back onto the boat after the initial strike. They were believed to be potentially in communication with others and salvaging some of the drugs. Because of that, it was determined they were still in the fight and valid targets. A JAG officer was also giving legal advice. So again, David, that video will be key, and Admiral Bradley will be on the Hill tomorrow behind closed doors.
Well, excuse me. We mentioned our senator, soon to be ex-senator, Tom Tillis, was quoted in media reports talking about this particular strike, saying, well, if it can be substantiated by facts that the strike was unnecessary or was malicious, he says, quote, it's a violation of both ethical and possibly legal requirements. If it is substantiated, whoever made that order needs to get the hell out of Washington. So in other words, he's saying... he's saying, you know, it's not a big deal if fentanyl continues to flow into our country, killing young people who sometimes ingest it unknowingly, killing young adult males who become very addicted to it, while also, you know, becoming addicted to opioids and other drugs. Tom Tillis is saying, you know, let's just err on the side of caution here and let's not stir things up too much in the open seas where the narco-terrorism is flourishing. Can't make it up. But interestingly enough, we got more support for the necessity of what these guys are doing. A 30-year veteran of the U.S. Coast Guard happened to call in to the Chris Plant radio show, the show which airs on these WEEB airwaves Monday through Friday, 9 to noon. This guy calls in from St. Louis to explain just how it is that terrorists are deterred. Play clip two.
I look back on the time when I was given smuggler's boat to use as a red team operation against the good guys day and night, multi-agency, multi-nation. And a lot of the lessons I learned. And I look at what's happened back and I say, wow, that's not what I would look at if I was an investigator for this. And I'd like to bring up about 5 points that I think that those who are looking into this really should pay attention to. The first variable I look at is the deadliness of the cargo. With 450 kilograms of fentanyl, the product on the boat had enough drugs to kill 225 million people. Now, to put that in perspective, that's 1,600 Hiroshima nuclear blasts in Japan. They killed. This would be the equivalent of 1,600 Hiroshimas. That said, if we were a Japanese nation in 1945, and we stopped the Indianapolis, the Navy vessel carrying in the core for what was called Little Boy, and we sunk the Indianapolis, and the core floated free, they would look to double-tap that core, not the survivors. The other thing I wanted to talk about is the doctrine right now under GIADF is that there's zero recovery doctrine. It's the basic premise that that no drug cartel should be able to pick up their products. And then the two really confounding issues are these. When you talk about survivors, when they think they see survivors, they must know this. If you vaporize fentanyl, the DEA says you probably have 1 to 30 seconds not to pass out. You would pass out and you would probably die there quickly thereafter. So if you're in a fireball full of fentanyl and it's been vaporized and you're breathing that in, you're probably not going to live more than a few minutes at best. Secondly, oftentimes, not every time, but oftentimes, smugglers are found to have personal flotation devices on board for their crew or their coxswains. If they had an inflatable horseshoe type, the more modern type, they could be wearing those, and they'd pop back to the surface within a few seconds.
So, in other words, these guys know what they're doing out there, and if we don't take them out when we have the chance, they will figure out a way to recover the drugs and continue the mission. Or if they, on the other hand, if they appear to be survivors, they may be guys who are a couple of minutes away from being dead survivors if they, you know, if they ingest the fentanyl. So, I mean, it's the whole thing is collapsing on itself. This whole narrative that this is somehow, you know, a lawless Trump Department of War raging in the open seas. It's just ridiculous.
Let me give it. Let me give a 50,000-foot view on this. Is here's what happened in a typical PSYOP misinformation campaign. The Washington Post, citing one anonymous source, came out and said, hey, very specific accusation, Hegseth ordered a second attack, and Hegseth ordered that those people be killed. That was the, excuse me, the accusations published by the Washington Post, quoting an anonymous source. 2 days later, the New York Times, who's no not a liberal rag, they came out with a story citing five administration officials that completely contradicted every single thing that the Washington Post said. And but here's what happened. The Washington Post did their story. All the leftists ran with it. Hegseth's a killer. All the leftists and The rhinos like Tom Tillis always out themselves. And once again, Tom Tillis was on the wrong side of the story. The interesting thing about this story is rather than piling on, the New York Times actually refuted what the Washington Post said. That's a remarkable about face for the New York Times. That's the real story here, is the New York Times told the truth.
It is remarkable. And I don't know what in the heck's going on at the New York Times, but in a somewhat related story, again, this one in Minnesota.
They must be on medication.
Yeah, and I don't know.
Lithium or something.
I mean, it's remarkable that they're suddenly, you know, stumbling on these acts of journalism not seen in decades. But here's the thing, shifting from the waters of the open seas to the frozen tundra of Minnesota, you know, we're learning now because of independent reporting and then picked up by the Times that there has been a criminal enterprise going on for years in Minnesota, directed by Somali criminals, basically. The Somalian population in Minnesota is massive. Tens and tens of thousands of people from Somalia have settled there. And with Governor Tim Walz, Mr. Lefty, vice presidential wannabe, at the helm, they have deliberately turned a blind eye to this Somalian sort of mafia that's been operating undeterred. Hundreds of millions of dollars siphoned from Medicaid, housing, mm-hmm. and other welfare programs.
By shock phase.
Including feeding our future, food assistance for needy families. This stuff has been going on for years in Minnesota, and the mainstream media has ignored it, even though the local TV station there has reported over the years on 59 arrests that have taken place. Well, those were all ignored until recently. The point is that if we do not seriously address the immigration crisis in our country, not only does it pose a threat to American citizens' well-being, their lives and their limbs, it can actually also economically weaken us as we get ripped off with these Somalian warlords profiting from all kinds of corruption under our noses. And if it's happening in Minnesota, it's got to be happening other places too, and we know that it is. And again, the left prefers to ignore that. But the other takeaway from what we're seeing in Minnesota and what we saw during the open borders era of the Biden regime, and now we have a country where we're deporting hundreds of thousands of these illegal immigrants and we're just barely making a dent in the population, what we see is an emboldened immigrant population that thinks that they really now are sort of large and in charge here in the homeland. Play clip 3.
You have lost. You lost. The mistake that you made is you let us in the first place. That's the thing with brown people. And I'm going to say this as a brown person. There's a lot of us. Like a lot. There's like 1.2 billion in India. There's more than 200 million in Pakistan. There's like 170 million in Bangladesh. And those are just the people there. I'm not even talking about the folks who are expats or immigrants. There's a bunch of us. And we breed. We're a breeding people. And the problem is you let us in 1965. There were a few of us beforehand. But once you let one of us in, you know what happens with brown folks? Our grandmother comes. Our grandfather comes. Our uncle comes. Our aunt comes. Our cousin comes. Our second cousin comes. Our third cousin comes. Then we have kids, a bunch of kids. And then guess what? Some white women, the Western civilization women, the pure women, the American women, quote unquote, the Rust Belt women, the real women, they like some of us brown folks. We don't take them. They come to us. So we're embedded. We are everywhere. We are everywhere. I've traveled this country. I'm going to speak as a brown person. Brown people are everywhere. There will be a Patel Motel or there will be a Desi restaurant everywhere. I want you to realize this. You have lost. Your story is a shitty story filled with misery. It's filled with bland chicken. It's filled with terrible, terrible dry ass meat. Your music sucks. All your culture sucks. That's why the kids like listen to black people and their music. That's why the kids love Latinos. Your parties suck because they're monochromatic. Our parties have better food, better music, better looking women.
Okay. Who's that racist?
He is a writer.
Washington Post.
Well, a New York Times op-ed contributing columnist.
No surprise there. Big racist.
He is someone who, I guess, is very well known in the far left circles.
So,
he is a very obnoxious and arrogant person. His name is Wahat Ali. Ali.
Okay, so here's Mr. Ali's fallacy, and this is intentionally misleading because we're not getting rid of brown people. We're getting rid of people who are here illegally. And it's always, oh, you're against us brown people. We're against us black people. I've seen plenty of pictures of Europeans being deported and Persian people being deported. But what these leftists intentionally do is they got to play identity politics, and they had to be victims. We are deporting illegal aliens and people who are here who shouldn't be here for various reasons. But the left always wants to turn everything into identity politics, and whether it's racism, sexism, God knows what ism they make up.
Well, and he's conflating the story here. I mean, in other words, we're deporting illegal immigrants. We're not deporting them because they're brown or some
correct.
Other color.
That's the point. That's the point. The true thing is we're enforcing the law. And you know what? If you're deporting immigrants in a town that's heavily Somalian illegal aliens, then you're going to deport mainly illegal aliens. Go to Little Ireland in New York and you're going to be deporting Irish people. Go to Pinehurst and you're going to be deporting, Scotsmen or wherever back to golf land. It's Right?
Yeah, but they're here legally. There's the big difference.
Well,
right?
the point is we're deporting people who, for various reasons, have broken the law. But the left always tries to make it about identity politics.
Completely. Yeah. And they're also promoting this narrative that all of these legal, with an L, legal immigrants, who, some of whom have been here for years, are all now living in the shadows because they fear deportation. How many times a week do we hear about large numbers of legal immigrants with an L who have been deported? Like zero times
correct,
a week?
Correct. Zero. It doesn't happen. But people believe it. It's amazing. The people who watch CNN, well, you see it on these stupid No Kings rallies. Take away my Social Security. Don't take it. The Trump administration is trying to save Social Security by getting rid of the fraud. It's not the Social Security program that's broke. It's all the fraud that's in it. It's all the illegal aliens that they've now proven have done it. Plus, in 2008, when the economy went south, to keep Obama's unemployment rate down, what they did is they took all the unemployed people, they moved them to long-term Social Security disability. You see that in the workplace workforce participation report published by the Federal Reserve. And what they did is they moved all these actual able-bodied people onto Social Security disability, and so they're getting paid Social Security for the rest of their life. They did that in 2008, 2009, 2010. They let all these illegal aliens on here. Trump's trying to strengthen it by getting rid of all that sort of fraud. But yet, these people who watch CNN are the clapping seals are out there protesting, hands off my Social Security. They're just mind-numb robot clapping seals.
Yeah, it's you can't make it up, and it's sad. It's really pathetic is what it is. Speaking of pathetic, though.
Oh, my God.
Boy, this scrapes the bottom of the pathetic barrel.
Are we moving on to school board topics?
No, we'll get to the school board in a moment, but this was a bombshell. Public embarrassment number one for the week. We do that now. Public embarrassment number one is the Food and Drug Administration, where one courageous man, who is the chief vaccine researcher, came forward and wrote a memo internally saying, we now know that the mRNA COVID jabs that we recommended be given to children as young as 6 months of age, barely out of the womb, we know that they have killed American children. We know of at least 10 cases, and he said, we can be sure that that number is an underestimate due to underreporting and inherent bias in attribution. So in other words, he's saying, it's not 10, it's hundreds. You can count on it. What happens? The memo is leaked. Now the whole world knows about it. Now all of those people who push these experimental vaxes, first of all, on adults and the elderly, and then shifted their little fangs toward the children, they are now being exposed, and this is scandalous. I mean, this is going to forever change the public's perception of the credibility of the Food and Drug Administration, of the Centers for Disease Control, of the National Institutes of Health. Robert Malone, who is a physician and one of the actual creators of mRNA technology and an early critic warning not to use mRNA as a vaccine to combat the so-called COVID virus, he says that the significance and importance of this leaked letter in the context of U.S. and global vaccine policy cannot be overestimated. This is a revolution, the likes of which I have never expected to see in my lifetime. The Washington Post called me a liar for stating what is now official FDA policy and truth. These products do not work. They do not prevent disease and death. The objective analysis cannot even demonstrate that on balance that they saved lives.
No, but they were effective. See, that safe perspective's wrong. No, I didn't say they were safe. I said they were effective because you know what they did? They managed to transfer trillions of dollars of wealth from future taxpayers in the form of debt, and they transferred it to Big Pharma and their buddies, right? And they stole an election. So from the Democrat and the uniparty rhinos perspective, all that was very effective. It just wasn't safe, and it destroyed the country.
And for the people that it's not that the jabs have not killed, they have nonetheless imposed on them vaccine injuries and repeated health issues. There's an NFL player who was out for a couple of months being treated for testicular cancer. Well, don't you suppose that probably could be linked to one of these jabs? We hear about once a week of some 20 or 30 something age person mysteriously drops dead.
Yeah. You notice the further away. You remember right after all the jabs happened and, you know, for a year or so after that, young athletes were dropping dead left and right, just like clutching, you know, boom, and dying on the field. And remember the mainstream media said, that's normal. You know, you just weren't paying attention. That happened all the time. You're sitting there thinking, I don't seem to recall that ever happening when, you know, I was in college. Notice it's not happening now, right? So there was this big, you know, bulge of it. And you know what? Again, we were right, you know, just like we were right about this MRA juice killing children. We're right about my, you know, the heart thing and
myocarditis.
Stuff. Thank you.
Is the principal reaction to young, healthy children and young men.
Yep.
To this jab, it's the heart inflammation,
yep.
Which
if you know a cardiologist or live near a cardiologist, either talk to them or pay attention to their workload, and you will find that they are the busiest people in the world post COVID because of all the COVID damage.
We have
COVID jab damages.
We have right here in North Carolina, former Carolina Hurricanes player. And NHL coach Kevin Dineen has revealed just this month that he has been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Young guy.
So are we picking at a scab?
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to say. Not quite as direct as I did at the opening part, but.
But anyway, you can go on and on about that. And the left will always say, well, yes, but think of all the lives that were saved. And think of all the teachers who didn't die because the kids were vaccinated.
Okay, so let's take that argument. I was hoping, God, a big thing, one of the rallying cries for gun control was the left would say, if it saves one child's life, we need to ban all guns. That was their rallying cry. If it saved the life of one child, and we're like, but look at all the good that guns do, right? Now look at kind of their argument. They don't care that it killed 100 children, right?
No,
we're gonna keep up with a jab. We don't care that it kills 100 kids. You cannot be a leftist without being a hypocrite.
No, that's sort of like factory installed, isn't it?
Correct.
That's in the the DNA.
Yes.
Well, it will really be interesting to see. I hope that the people who were responsible, Anthony Fauci and others, are held to account for their negligence in the completely reckless promotion of these jabs for, you know, over a period of years and years. And we're going to get to another story later that relates to the same jab mania. But let's talk about some of the big stories you might have missed last week when you were busy going about your lives and bouncing back from your Thanksgiving break. This is a great story. At the University of Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain.
And the waving wheat.
The state that gave us David Hensley.
Yes, sir.
A young student there, she is in a class. Her name is Samantha Fulnicki. She was assigned to write a 650-word essay. That's a not a very long essay. As part of a
They should ban those. You know, if Robin Calcutt and Amy Dahl were and Davis were on the board of trustees, they would end essays at the University of Oklahoma. So unfair. Those teachers should have academic freedom. It's probably a mandated book report. Sorry, well,
it is mandated. And so this was part of a psychology course analyzing an article that all the students read on the experience of gender, peer relations, and mental health. In her essay, this student, young Samantha, rejected the concept of multiple genders and cited the Bible to support her view that traditional gender roles should not be considered stereotypes.
Once upon a time, that view was tolerated at the University of Oklahoma.
Well, it's not as tolerated as you might think because guess what? Story goes viral, okay? Fox News, so on and so forth.
Yeah, she got an F, right?
Turning point, she got an F. She got a zero out of 20 on a 25-point scale. An absolute zero for saying that the role of women is to be womanly. She actually used that term.
Yeah.
But the university had to react to this because it went so viral. And on Sunday, it announced that the instructor has been placed, that would be last Sunday, the instructor has been placed on administrative leave, and the school has promised to investigate the incident, urged on by the state's governor, who I believe is a Republican, and the Turning Point USA chapter at OU, which triggered a 44 million page viral view of its social media post about the plight of this student. On Wednesday, university officials said that two assignments the student had questioned would not count toward her final grade in the course. She wrote, and I certainly, this is what we need more of on college campuses, is students who have the courage to stand up for what they believe. She wrote, "Society pushing the lie that there are multiple genders and everyone should be whatever they want to be is demonic and severely harms American youth." She wrote that in her wonderful essay.
She should join me in being on the Moore County School Board.
She should. Well, you could probably use a fellow sooner there to, you know, for a little backup. But let's talk about that for a minute since you brought it up. The school board will be meeting on Monday. For the regularly scheduled December meeting.
Yes, it'll be, and the way things are looking, it'll be the last business meeting where we actually vote on an action item.
So we know that this current school board, as constituted, has been dead set against all things that come out of your mouth, sensible things.
It's not that. I mean, the county commissioners tried to talk to them, and all Davis and Calcutt did is read prepared statements insulting them. The Carthage commissioners came down, and again, they weren't very welcome. So the educrats in charge of the school board do not want discussion and debate on any topic. They no longer are going to tolerate votes on any topics because they don't want to go on the record as voting for or against stuff.
So what they will do is they will abuse a procedure called the consent agenda. And the consent agenda is intended to be the place where a board, a body that meets regularly, can place routine items that don't really require voting or action or input, routine stuff like here's next year's calendar of holidays.
We're going to pay the power bill.
Yeah,
you know, right. Okay, yeah, pay. Right. We don't need to debate, discuss paying the power
bill. We have a new vendor for, you know, bologna for our sandwiches, whatever. So
is it OSCAR?
Bologna
has a first name.
So the consent agenda has a proper role in the conduct of a body such as a school board. But what the evil empire is trying, it will do apparently on Monday.
Oh
your
my
prediction.
God! The tyranny of the majority is going to strike.
They are going to adopt a policy whereby virtually all actionable items will be placed on the consent agenda at a prior work session. And that it will take not one board member, but three in order to request that a single or one or more items be removed from the consent agenda so that it may be discussed in an open public meeting during which a vote could be held, during which the public could air its concerns about a given topic. They want to push all that into the shadows under the consent agenda. What's the word? Strategy, I guess. It's a strategy. And but the ultimate outcome of that will mean that the substantive items that David Hensley brings to the fore, like financial, the whole Carthage Elementary School,
water and siding. Oh my God! Look at all this stuff. The SROs not being trained for 5 years. Yeah. Fixing the testing the water at Carthage, testing the stuff at Aberdeen Elementary. The list goes on and on of stuff that we've identified and fixed. But what their policy is going to do? This is absolutely amazing. So there's a work session. The first Monday of the month, then there's the business meeting. No one pays attention to the work session. The public attends the business meeting. The public speaks at the business meeting. And what they do is they're going to pass a policy on Monday. It's already determined that everything that's discussed in the work session automatically goes on the consent agenda. That means there's not, after this meeting, there will be no discussion and debate or vote on single items. They're just going to pass everything in one. What's that spending bill they pass in Congress that everyone
has? Omnibus?
There's going to be an omnibus where no one's held accountable. You can't say, oh, hey, who voted to ban book reports? Who voted to keep that book in? Every single thing, there'll be no accountability for any elected official because there'll be no votes on the record on any individual item, and there'll be no public discussion and debate. Wow. And here's the point, right? Here's the point. There's a couple of things about this. One is they chose, so if you want to take something off the consent agenda, three board members have to approach the chair before and remove it from the consent agenda. Why three? Well, Pauline and I generally oppose some of the stuff, right? So they made it three because their little voting block is five, right?
That would be Pauline Bruno, your fellow school board member.
Yes. And then, so they made it so that me and Pauline, they took away any rights that Pauline and I have to address anything. And they made it three because next time when their clock gets clean in the school board elections and it's coming, they're going to have three of them. It will be Calcutt, Dahl, and Johnson. And guess what? With that magic number three, they'll be able to do what Pauline and I can't. This is underhanded, devilish. This is like Dr. Evil level stuff that they're doing. And it's complete. Literally, the school board meeting's going to be show up, pledge of allegiance, awards, profiles, and that's it. Zero votes, zero public debate. And what this does is this illustrates the complete, absolute control that leftists wants of stuff and that educrats do. If you want to know why public education is failing, look no further than PhD Calcutt and PhD Dahl. They want no discussion. They want no outside input. They're in this little groupthink thing, and they want to increase the groupthink by not getting any outside input. So they're the reason public schools are failing, because of educrats like them. Plus, look at the leftists are in charge, and they want no discussion, no debate. They want 100% conformity, where I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum. I want everyone's input. You know, you've seen it. Calcutt and Davis don't even let the public speak. How many times have they voted to not let the public speak when I've been like introducing votes for the public to speak? They're just a bunch of leftist academic elitists who want zero discussion and debate, and what they it's their way or the highway.
But therefore, that would tell me that the first Monday of the month work sessions, they're called, which they're essentially still public meetings.
Yes.
Now will become must viewing, won't it? They're both entertaining and informative.
Right, but the fact is, by the time they let the public speak on any given thing, It's on the consent agenda. It's not going to change anything. So the process is the school board pontificates among themselves, assuming Calcutt's not gaveling them down in the work session that no one pays attention to. We go to the business meeting that people do pay attention to, and the people speak out on the top topics that are on the agenda. But guess what? No one will vote on them because they're on the consent agenda. It's going to be a foregone conclusion. They're going to pass. And that's what PhD Calcutt, PhD Dahl, Shannon Davis, Ken Benway voted for this, by the way. Ken Benway voted for this. Ken Benway is behind this. The other thing that happened in the last board meeting is we elected a chair and a vice chair, right?
Yeah, you did.
And, Calcutt was nominated for the chair, and I was nominated for the chair, and they were getting ready to vote. And I'm like, hey, wait, time out. Before we vote, I think that other board members might be interested in what Calcutt is going to do as chair, or what my ideas are. More importantly, the public wants it. So
her plan.
Robin, before we vote for you for chair, what exactly is your platform? What's your vision for Moore County Schools? What are you going to do as chair for the next year? She got this horrible look on her face, looked at the attorney and said, can he ask that question? First of all, Robin Calcutt's a grown adult. She's been the chair for a year. She spent school funds to buy each of us a copy of Robert's Rules of Orders. A year into her term, she's still asking the attorney how we modify an agenda or whatever. Anyway, the attorney stammered a bit, and then he goes, well, no, this is debatable. So, yes, he has a right to ask that question. And Robin couldn't ask the question. She could not answer that question. So then the attorney volunteered, but someone could call a question, and that would if you got a vote, then it's... So then Davis called the question to prevent Robin from having to answer the question, what's she going to do as chair? Shannon Davis introduced a motion to call the question, and the vote was 5-2. Benway joined them, so that shut down any questions for any candidates running for chair. So Calcutt didn't have to answer the question. Then 5 of the board members voted for Calcutt, who couldn't or wouldn't even answer what she was going to do. 5 people voted for someone who couldn't or wouldn't say what she was going to do for chair. Then we come to vice chair. Davis is nominated. So we're going to have the same team. The same team has been a disaster
Shannon
for
Davis,
last year.
Not a PhD, Shannon Davis.
Right. Anyway, so I asked her the same question. Amy Dahl called the question. It passed 5-2 to call the question. So Shannon Davis did not have to say what she, what her vision was. And then 5 of them voted for Shannon Davis, who would not even say what her plan was, to include Ken Benway. Ken Benway is the biggest Quisling since, Mr. Quisling himself was a Quisling.
It's disappointing what can happen to people when they sit on these boards and they get kind of comfortable with being sort of, an authoritarian figure who controls the destiny of children and teachers and everything. It's really remarkable.
We were elected to have discussion and debate and represent the people. And Calcutt, Davis, Benway, Johnson, and whoever else I left out, Dahl, want nothing. Wait and see. Literally tune in Monday and stand by to be appalled.
Yeah. So the school board meetings are available via YouTube, live streaming. They kick off at 5:30. Typically, is that right?
Yes, the live they start at 4, and we go into closed session, and then that's where Davis illegally asked for free tickets in exchange for us approving a contract for the PGA, so we get that stuff out
USGA,
of the way.
USGA, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the public portion starts. At 5:30.
And if you can't make it, because they like to start the meetings at 5:30 to minimize attendance by the public, but if you can't make it, you can tune in via YouTube and see all the shenanigans going on and
stock up on popcorn
and
man.
Watch David Hensley stand in the breach
and Pauline
Bruno.
Alongside
yes,
me.
Yes, indeed. So that's something to keep in mind for next week. I think another education related story that I'd like to talk about briefly is this House Bill 193, which did become law on December 1. It was a House bill that was also reflected a similar legislation from a Senate bill, which was adopted by the House bill. Basically, what it does is it allows Christian schools that are on property where there is a house of worship to be protected by members of the staff who have attained concealed carry permits. They can carry firearms, concealed carry. They undergo some additional training. They must have at least 8 additional hours of training annually, and they must be approved to carry to have possession of firearms by the school board, the church leadership, or other authority organizations. So to me, this makes a world of sense that these Christian private schools, which, as we know, are targets of these extreme lefties, especially the transies. Mm-hmm. We've seen too many cases of Christian schools being targeted. But I guess that kind of begs the question, why would this not be viable in public schools?
I wish there would. I mean, you know, the best way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good person with a gun. And look, I'm glad to see this, and I'm glad that publics or private schools, or at least religious-based, I'm glad to see private schools can take security in their own hands. Unfortunately, that's going to make our public schools even more vulnerable because, look, a nut job's going to just, you know, lose it and do what nut jobs do. But anyone who puts any thought into it, you know, terrorists seek soft targets. And what you don't want to be is the softest target in town. And, you know, you look at Lee County, the sheriff provides their SROs. They have SROs at every school. And most of the counties around us where, you know, the sheriff provides the SROs, they have much better coverage, which makes more county a more vulnerable target. Well, you know, if the private schools all have their faculty and staff armed, then that just, you know, it just makes us an even more vulnerable target. So that's why we got to square away our school resource officers.
And we can't repeat this enough. How many schools in Moore County are not protected by armed security?
13 out of 23, almost 60% of our schools are not protected by an SRO, and that is much worse than all the surrounding counties where the SROs are provided by the sheriff or municipal departments.
So while they're ignoring these very real problems in our culture, the left is instead, as we mentioned at the top of the show, they're concerned about us going after terrorists and drug runners on the open seas. They're also very concerned about a theme that they can't repeat often enough called affordability. Now, I don't know about you, but I can't remember a time when I've heard more media and left-wing references to affordability. And there, actually, believe it or not, a columnist in the Wall Street Journal took it upon himself to write a column basically saying that affordability cannot be solved in the traditional sense of how you solve a problem. Because, he says, it's very simple. Affordability as a crisis defies definition and thus resolution. It is not a synonym for inflation. And though it is above the Federal Reserve's 2%, at 3%, our inflation is under control. Affordability means the resources to pay for goods and services. By that standard, the simple metric that you would follow is real incomes. Well, currently, real incomes are recovering from both the pandemic as well as the Biden regime. So there's always something going up in price and something going down. And what he says is that there is no, in reality, affordability crisis. And another a commentator who weighed in on that warns that it would be a mistake for Republicans to try to respond to this with the coming 2026 midterms. It is important to focus on the economy, but not in the context of this fake affordability narrative. Play clip 5.
My message to the Trump administration and all of you listening is tune out all of the street theater, all the pornography, all the smutty language, all the insurrectionary activity, and just focus on the economy and talk. Two points. How much better it is already than the average of the 4 years prior, but more importantly, demonstrate why it's going to be booming in 2026 and why the Democrats don't want you to think about that.
It's a very good point, because there are economic signs. We do expect inflation to come down further in 2026. We see that the constant obsession with the price of eggs is no longer an issue. They're down 66%.
Well, that means it's favorable, right?
Yeah. The average 30-year fixed mortgage rate is all the way down to 6% now.
Wow.
12% lower than just a year ago when Trump took office. Real wages are up $700 per household, on track to go up to $1,200. So in other words, the signs are good. The metrics that matter are trending upward. And so instead of getting caught up in this Zoran Mamdani socialist, you know, I'm going to make housing affordable by making it free. I'm going to make groceries affordable by making them more accessible at lower prices. I'm going to make healthcare free. I'm going to make bus rides free. We don't want to engage in that debate. That's a waste of time because it's insanity in full view on the left.
So just real quick, when Trump first got elected, you know, immediately he started doing stuff. During his second term, he immediately started taking on all issues, economic, foreign, American, you know, birthright and all that stuff. And he did that immediately. He did everything as fast as possible for two reasons. One is in case there's court challenges that it will make it all the way to the Supreme Court while he's there to defend it. Because if you start something your third or fourth year, you're not going to be able to defend it at the Supreme Court. The second thing is he's smart enough to realize that the midterms are important. And if you really want to affect the economy and do stuff by the second year that you're in office, you got to start on day one. So, you know, Trump was very smart, very strategic to front load everything so he could defend it in court, and fingers crossed, pray to God that his economic packages, you know, really take effect and we see results, good results in 2026. And I think we will, because everything's headed the right direction.
You're absolutely right. And there was a huge development that happened earlier in the week, when the Trump administration announced that it will lower requirements for passenger car emissions and fuel economy to make them more what? Well, affordable.
Affordable.
Now
right.
that
regulation makes stuff more expensive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this foolishness about, oh, all the cars are going to be electric in California by 2050. I mean, that's out the window. That's absurd. That's insane. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants them. That's why EV sales are plummeting, and car makers are laying off thousands of factory workers that were going to build these electric vehicles. Now, you know, on this show, we love common sense. We like to shine a bright light on people who have functional brains. And I came across this quarterback for the New York Giants, Jackson Dart. And somebody asked him a question about taking a particularly hard hit during a recent game playing for the Giants. And I thought his response was just classic. Play clip six.
I understand the question. But like, this is football. Like, I'm going to get hit if I'm in the pocket or outside the pocket. Like, I feel like I've played this way my whole entire life. It shouldn't be like any shocker to anybody if you've followed along with my career. We're not playing soccer out here. Like, you're gonna get hit, things happen. It's part of the game.
It's nice to hear some common sense from a football player that, hey, there might be some tackling.
And he's the guy who got hit.
Yeah, exactly.
And by the way, if you didn't see the game, that was a perfect old school just football hit. It
Absolutely.
Was a clean hit. I'm glad to see this quarterback recognize that.
I hope he can find a team that's got some talent so he can win some games.
Right.
Well, we take the hits here for you, and that's why we get together every Saturday. We are rooting out hypocrisy and deception and consent agendas and other forms of corruption. I'm Steve Woodward. He's David Hensley. Join us again next week when we'll be right here doing what we do best,
taking aim.